and discover how a modern commercial vehicle from Ford doesn't cost the earth. Ford, go further. Terms and conditions apply. See Ford.ie for details.
I'm Dan, owner, MD and employee of the month here at CD Shack. Some people say to me, CDs are over. I say, go on with that. Just last week, I sold two Kenny Rogers albums and a Beyonce to a lad in an old car. Fabulous.
CD Shack is not an Energia customer because CD Shack is not a clever business. People like Dan don't recognise that switching and slicing up to 20% off your energy bills is just, well, the clever business thing to do. If you're a clever business, visit energia.ie/business to find out how you can save. Savings based on our standard business rate. Terms and conditions apply. See energia.ie.
Living a busy life and want to avoid colds and flu? When you start feeling run down, reach for Avogel Echinaforce, made from fresh echinacea herb. Avogel Echinaforce is a natural remedy that helps fight colds and flu by strengthening the body's immune system. Avogel Echinaforce, available at health stores and pharmacies nationwide. Always read the leaflet.
Love is beautifully crafted windows and doors, outstanding energy efficiency, and 35% off new windows and doors this month. Love is McMahon and Nagel Windows and Doors. Visit mcmnwindows.ie or call 01846-0364 for a design consultation. McMahon and Nagel. Fall in love with your home again.
For the joy of discovering somewhere new. For the time spent together. For the stories you'll take back home. For the journey that's part of your holiday. For anyone planning their next trip, sail and stay in France and save up to 15%. Visit brittanyferries.ie now. Conditions apply.
The Pat Kenny Show
with MasterCard. Tantalise your taste buds with exclusive dining experiences at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
Still to come on the programme, we've the latest as Gardaí reopened the case of the Kerry babies as new DNA information comes to light. Should all healthcare workers be forced to get the flu vaccination? We'll be looking at the latest procedure available for the treatment of varicose veins with Professor Austin Leahy. Could build to rent be the solution to the property crisis? Former Harvard lecturer and author of a new rulebook for avoiding chaos in your life will be telling us all about that. And Jess Kelly bought a new toy in Las Vegas, but is Alexa eavesdropping on conversations that you don't want her to hear? You can join the conversation on Twitter, hashtag PKNT. But now the news and Michelle McMillan.
On 106 to 108 FM and at newstalk.com. This is News Talk.
It's 10 o'clock. Good morning. Gardaí have reopened their inquiry into the discovery of a baby's body on a beach in Kerry over 30 years ago. Cold case detectives have been reviewing the file on the death of baby John and have a new DNA profile from a blood sample taken at the time. A Tralee woman and her family confessed to his killing but later recanted. Gardaí will today renew their appeal for information. Irish Examiner journalist Catherine Shanahan has been following the story.
Forensic science or technology had developed to the point now where they have been able to generate this full DNA profile. So I suppose on foot of that, they're now going back to the public, launching an appeal today. They're revisiting the case. They're saying, look, if anyone in the Abbey Dorney area or the wider surrounds has any information that can help us solve this case, that's why it's reopened.
A new survey shows there's an urban-rural divide when it comes to TDs' views on abortion. The Irish Independent says the number of deputies opposed to unrestricted abortion up to 12 weeks is four times greater in rural Ireland than in Dublin. Fine Gael's parliamentary party held a five-hour meeting yesterday to decide their stance on the issue. They've decided members will be allowed a free vote on any potential law change. Deputy Kate O'Connell told Pat Kenny it's the right choice.
The vote would probably pass, I'd imagine at this stage, looking at the figures, will pass through the chamber without a whip. So why upset people? Why cause undue annoyance at this stage?
And TDs who returned from their Christmas break this morning were greeted by protesters outside Leinster House. Among them was the Inner City Helping Homeless group. They're highlighting the thousands of children still without permanent homes. In Limerick now, in a book of condolences opening online for Dolores O'Riordan. The Cranberries frontwoman was found dead in London yesterday at the age of 46. She was there for a short recording session. The police in Westminster say her death is still unexplained. And finally, 13 siblings have been rescued from a foul-smelling room in California, where they were apparently held captive by their parents. One managed to escape the house in Paris and tell police, who found some of the others chained to their beds. The mum and dad have been charged with torture. Mark Uffer is from the medical centre, where some of the siblings are being cared for.
We pull out all the stops, so to speak, to make sure that their privacy is dealt with, that they get the appropriate care, and that they are treated with dignity and respect at a time when they need it the most.
And that full story and photos are on newstalk.com. That's it for now. More at 11.
Newstalk and offtheball.com.
Brought to you by Spirit Jaguar. Drive like everyone's watching in Jaguar's newest cub, the E-Pace compact SUV. SpiritJaguar.ie.
Roger Federer's had a good start to the defence of his Australian Open men's singles title in Melbourne. The 19-time Grand Slam winner has just completed a straight set win over Alias Bedene. It took just an hour and 40 minutes to complete a 6-3, 6-4, 6-3 victory over the former British number two. Novak Djokovic is also through to the second round following a straight set win over Donald Young. There were also wins for Maria Sharapova and Joanna Konta this morning, but two-time Wimbledon champion Petra Kvitova has suffered a first-round defeat. Manchester United are said to be confident of signing Alexis Sanchez despite Chelsea's late interest. United are the front runners for the Chilean striker after Manchester City withdrew their interest. Chelsea have yet to make a formal bid to Arsenal, but manager Antonio Conte says he's a player who's been interested in the past.
He's a great player, and he knows very well that in my first season in Juventus, we tried to buy him from Udinese, and then he decided to go to Barcelona.
For offtheball.com on Newstalk, I'm Ross Lindsay.
Henry Ford once famously said, "You can have any colour you want as long as it's black." Well, today, whatever colour you choose from Ford, you'll always be buying green. And with Ford's smarter, innovative engine technologies, you'll be driving all of our commitment towards a cleaner environment and cleaning up with an incredible bonus of up to €6,000. So upgrade to a brand new Ford today and discover how owning a modern Ford doesn't cost the earth. Ford. Go further. Terms and conditions apply. See Ford.ie for details.
News Talk weather.
Thanks to Des Kelly Interiors, where quality costs less at our new look stores across Leinster. Surprise yourself at deskelly.ie.
Three weather warnings in place today. Watch out for snow and ice, as well as strong winds and flooding. Highest temperatures at just 1 to 5 degrees. Man, I are up to date on News Talk.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Some of the comments about Richard's report from Belfast. The Northern Ireland electorate have gotten the politicians they deserve. Until they stop voting for extremists on both sides, nothing will change. Neil in Dublin says, in Dublin 6, is there another country in the world where people speaking their native language are deemed to have kidnapped it? My point was that it was, if you like, co-opted by one side. But here's another one from Paddy. He says, in the west of Scotland, the Free Presbyterian Church uses Scots Gaelic in their religious services, and it's the spoken language in that part of Scotland. What about a Gaelic Language Act as a compromise? Well, now, on April the 12th, 1984, Joanne Hayes, a 24-year-old woman, gave birth to a son in a field on the family farm in Abbeydorney in County Kerry. The baby did not survive, and Joanne attempted to hide the body of the infant. She was brought to Tralee Hospital, where she denied having given birth. This was one of two events in County Kerry in the space of a few days in April 1984 that would set off one of the strangest and perhaps most revealing cases in the history of modern Ireland. Then, 2 days later, on April the 14th in 1984, the body of a newborn baby was found some 75 miles away on White Strand in Carrigsaveen. The boy, who had become known as Baby John, had stab wounds to the heart. Gardaí investigating the case of Baby John arrested Joanne Hayes for the murder. Under questioning, she signed a statement saying she had killed the baby in her house. Members of Joanne's family also signed statements to the same effect. The family would later claim they were put under pressure to sign these statements. In an attempt to prove her innocence, Joanne Hayes offered to show the Gardaí the location of the body of her baby in the field in Abbeydorney, which she said would prove she could not be the mother of the baby on the beach, but the offer was refused. Joanne told her family where to find the baby's body on the farm, and tests were able to show that the two babies had different blood types. When this emerged, the charges against Joanne Hayes were dropped on the instructions of the DPP. Public outcry over the investigation grew and a tribunal was established to examine the Garda investigation. Garda put forward the theory that Joanne Hayes had given birth to twins of different fathers, a massively rare phenomenon known as superfecundation. That tribunal became the site of protests from people, mostly women, outraged at the treatment of the young Kerry woman, and today it remains a powerful reminder of what a different country Ireland was just three decades ago. Today in Carrigshaveen, Gardaí will announce at a press conference that they are to review the case of the Kerry babies as they now have built a full DNA profile from a blood sample taken from the body of the baby on the beach. Now, Anne Lucy is a freelance journalist in County Kerry and someone who's had a close relationship with this story since its early days, and Anne is on the line. Anne, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, take us back to 1984 and the Kerry, and indeed the Ireland of that time. Were people shocked by what unfolded?
Yes, I think they were. I think there were sort of multiple reactions, really. You had an older generation who just simply, and they didn't need DNA testing to tell them that a woman couldn't have, two children or by two different fathers at the same time. Nobody believed that. But they were also shocked at what was coming out about in the 1980s about extramarital affairs and stuff. Now, you must remember, Pat, that contraception was not widely available then. You'd had the divisive referendum, which we are again facing. So I'm not so certain that rural Ireland was that different to what things are today. We're still having a divisive referendum now on the whole question of abortion. That actually split the country in 1983. I would have been a young woman at the time. You had the young, say, I would have been in my 20s, my early 20s, and that generation felt even quite different to people 10 years older. There was a big shift in society taking place at the time. People everywhere were quite shocked at the treatment of Joanna Hayes. I think particularly younger women were shocked. You had a very homogenous Ireland as well, Pat. I don't think you would have seen many people of colour in Kerry, or even I think what you did have at the time was you had a lot of hippies moving in around Kinmare. They brought their own changes and their own exotic influence on the place, particularly South Kerry and West Limerick and West Cork. So that was the kind of society you're talking about. It was still very much church-ridden society. It was very male-dominated. And it was, I think, women all over Kerry, particularly South Kerry and in North Kerry, were more or less hunted down if they were suspected of having affairs or children, and that they could possibly be the something to do with that baby in Carrigshaveen.
Now, the idea that someone would be arrested for the body that was found on the beach in Carrigshaveen, some 75 miles away from where Joanne Hayes lived in Abbeydorney, and the notion that she had somehow had a baby, killed it, and dropped the baby into the waters, and it was carried
off the cliff and carried on the tide was the theory.
Now, there are so many assumptions here.
There are huge assumptions. I think they were trying to tie all in together. The Gardaí that had information about a woman presenting with what was a suspected miscarriage at the hospital. I think it would have been even St. Catherine's at the time, hospital in Tralee. And I think they acted, and to be fair, on that information after speaking with health workers. But I was speaking with a superintendent in charge of Kerry this morning, Superintendent Flor Murphy, and they don't know whether that child found in the White Strand in Carrigshaveen, it was a frenzied attack. The child had multiple 3 or 4 days old, multiple stab wounds. He was murdered. Was thrown into the water. He was found in a plastic bag or was placed in the rocks. That is still not known.
So the Gardaí anyway came up with this theory, which was that Joanne Hayes had two babies, twins, and one was, well, they didn't know about the first one. She said she knew where the body was and she would show it to them. They chose not to believe that at the beginning, but then inevitably, when the body was produced and her story was shown to be true, they came up with this theory for the tribunal. which was designed, it would appear, to square the circle of their evidence that she had, you know, because they had got a confession from her and from members of her family, that would make sense of that, even though it made sense to nobody else.
That's right. I mean, it was a whole kind of a concoction, I suppose is what you call it. It was the sort of the last line of defence in what was a very, very poor handling of a situation. And
I mean, the question remains, why did they sign those statements? Now, Joanne Hayes would have been regarded as someone, you know, a humble person. Without having the kind of wherewithal, perhaps, to withstand the pressure of an interrogation.
Oh, indeed. And I think her aunt would have been involved as well, who was elderly and who had been a nurse at one stage, I think. And I think they were just frightened into the whole thing. I mean, it was, you know, having, they would have been very law-abiding people. There would have never been anything about them, or they wouldn't be used to courts or tribunals or lawyers or guards or anything like that, and to be suddenly suspected. And you see, Pat, I would, looking back now, see that there's a whole dovetailing of inverted commas morality. I mean, she was having an affair with a married man, and what was illegal? I mean, there were certain grey areas there. I'm sure people felt that, you know, what was moral was legal and vice versa. At the time, there was a sort of a confusion. We were very much like, I often imagine we were almost a Taliban kind of a state when it came to women, you know, the whole, even the covering issue at mass. I mean, you mean the not being allowed. It might have even been unusual 10 years previously or 20 years previously for a woman to be driving. You had all sorts of things. You had no freedom of country. It is actually seismic, the shift in society when you think. So if you place yourself back there, whether you were intelligent or you weren't intelligent, or whether you were all fair with the world or not, it was still a terrifying place to live as a young woman and to be, you know, to have that descended upon you. But what I'm hearing this morning, Pat, too, is that there's likely to be some kind of form of apology proffered by the Gardaí on behalf of the Garda in Cathaveen at 2 o'clock. It was certainly being considered at one stage. So I think that there may be an apology about the whole handling of that case this afternoon in Cathaveen. And I think the appeal is going to centre on you didn't actually need DNA to rule Joanna Hayes out.
No, the blood alone, blood grouping was blood enough grouping to rule her out. The question of what they can do now, I mean, number one, I would say all of the Gardaí who were involved in that case, given it's so long ago, have retired by now. Certainly the senior Gardaí would have had to have retired. Maybe some of the very junior people might be on the force, but I doubt it very much. So it's a whole new cohort of Gardaí officers who will be involved in this. What do they hope to achieve?
What they hope to achieve is hopefully somebody will come forward with new information about a woman or a young girl or a schoolgirl who had a child who was pregnant and then was no longer pregnant at the time. This is the way it was explained to me this morning. And that then they hope then, or which was pointed out to me, that perhaps somebody will come forward with information as to who the father was or may have been. And then they could use the DNA to sort of establish if there was indeed a link and finally resolve the case. Because there's another thing about this. It is always the Cathaveen baby, that baby and baby John of the White Strand, has kind of haunted people and has come to prominence every so often. The headstone was badly vandalised. The headstone, the grave, I think, is interfered with now and again. And the headstone was badly smashed in 2004, Pat. And people down there will tell you of finding maybe the odd little memento, like a toy or a token left on the grave as well. So it is a mystery that could, that should be solved. But it is also, as pointed out to me this morning, it's also a murder. That child was stabbed multiple, or baby was stabbed multiple times. So there is, you know, there's a huge mystery, really, Pat, that could be resolved, I suppose. But that's basically what they hope to achieve, that, you know, DNA testing, basically, it either proves or disproves. And then they can, you know, if they get information locally, if somebody finally now, 34 years later, comes forward, you know, it could be resolved. Yeah. I mean, that child is not necessarily from that area at all.
Yeah, well, that is the hope, that there will be some resolution with this DNA profiling of baby John.
I think there's a certain sensitivity too about, you know, that Miss Hayes perhaps, because it was stressed to me too that they're told, Gardaí, you're totally focused on the Caherty-Bean baby. You know, that's what they want to resolve.
All right. Well, Anne Lucy, freelance journalist in County Kerry, thank you very much for joining us. A case that continues to fascinate so many years later. Coming up next, the search for happiness should be replaced with a search for meaning. That's according to a clinical psychologist who will be telling us all about that in his new book. And he'll also be commenting on why women tend to marry up. That's next.
Moncrief.
Marla is a professional musher. She's a team of 20-something huskies. She demonstrated for us how she kind of sings to her dog. She does a kind of a doggy yelp.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Moncrief.
With Gas Networks Ireland.
Back today.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, we got that. We definitely got that.
On News Talk. If you're going to do America in 2018, do it with American Holidays and United. Whether you're thinking about trips to New York, Las Vegas, Miami, Orlando, a Caribbean cruise, or a musical tour of the Deep South, American Holidays have January sale deals on all these and more. Visit our website AmericanHolidays.com now to plan your next American adventure. Book now, as sales prices are limited. AmericanHolidays.com.
Hi, I'm Dara Horkin, Supervalue store owner. At Supervalue, we've dropped the prices on hundreds of Supervalue essentials, like Supervalue tuna chunks and brine, 160 gram, was €1.05, now 79 cent. And Supervalue squeezy real or light mayonnaise, 425 mil, was 95 cent, now only 79 cent. The super, the value, at Supervalue we do both.
Paul, good to see you.
Some game.
Yeah. How have you been?
Last time we spoke, you were feeling a bit down. You weren't yourself.
Yeah, I was under a lot of pressure in work. It was just weighing on me. And I was drinking too much as well. That didn't help. Feeling better now, though. Back running again and eased off on the pints.
Great to hear. Listen, if there's anything I can ever do, let me know.
Thanks, Brian.
If you struggle with anxiety, stress or depression, alcohol may make things worse. Find out how alcohol impacts your health at askaboutalcohol.ie from the HSE.
In business, reputation is everything, which explains the success of the award-winning Toyota ProAce, carrying up to 1.4 tonnes with exceptional fuel economy, all from just €17,310 ex-VAT. The incredible ProAce range, now with a trade-in booster of up to €4,000 or APRs from 0%. See toyota.ie. Toyota, built for a better world. Lending criteria, terms and conditions apply. Price excludes delivery and related charges. Finance is provided by way of a hire purchase agreement by Toyota Financial Services.
If you're looking for a van that delivers on quality at a price that's right for you, it's got to be an LDV. For comfort, safety, efficiency and all-round delivery, it can only be an LDV. For a van that always goes the extra mile for your business, it has to be the award-winning LDV. With 5 years warranty and 5 years roadside assist, check out the extensive 181 range now and future-proof your drive. Find your nearest dealer at ldv.ie. LDV, part of the Harris Group.
Thelma Mansfield talks about care at home.
Ireland is living longer. Taking care of our loved ones is now a priority, so choosing the right care partner is critical. You need to talk to Home Instead Senior Care. They'll advise you on a care plan that's tailored to your needs. You see, Home Instead have the experience and the expertise. Talk to them in good time.
Find out more at homeinstead.ie.
Fly to London City Airport from just €39 with CityJet's January flight sale. And that incredible fare includes CityJet's famous free seat selection, free checked bag and free drinks and snacks. So you can appreciate yourself as much as we at CityJet appreciate you. CityJet. Be appreciated. Terms and conditions apply.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With MasterCard. Escape the hustle and bustle with relaxing spa and hotel experiences at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
My next guest is a clinical psychologist who's lectured at Harvard and the University of Toronto on topics ranging from the Bible to personalities and relationships. In his latest book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, he says the search for happiness is a pointless goal. Instead, we should be searching for meaning. I'm joined on the the line now by Professor Jordan Peterson. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, where did the inspiration for this book come from? Because the idea of having 12 rules, which if we obey, our life will be less chaotic.
Well, that's the plan. The book has a long genesis. It emerges out of work I've been doing over, I would say, the last 30 years on totalitarianism and other forms of belief. And this is a distillation of all that work into something that I'm hoping has public appeal, which seems to have public appeal as well. So that's how it came about. I'm looking for a way that people can regulate their lives and organize their lives without falling prey to ideological temptation and possession, let's say, because that's just too dangerous.
The idea, though, of 12 simple mantras that will sort everything out. I mean, we start off on...
Well, I wouldn't say they were simple.
No, but what I was going to say is that when I start reading your book, I realize that, for example, in chapter 1, stand up straight with your shoulders back. It sounds very simple. Mm-hmm. And then I start to read and realize that it's sort of metaphorically standing straight as well as physically.
Yes, well, I would say that's the case for all of the rules. Like, because I'm a clinical psychologist and philosophically inclined, I like abstractions, but I also really like practicalities. And so what happens is that I start with a simple rule in the book and then open up the huge, what would you call it, cavern of ideas that's underneath it. And then bring it back to the close again, bring it up back up to the practical surface by the end of the rule. And so it's a hybrid, the book, a hybrid between, I would say, abstract philosophy and psychology, but also very, very practical day-to-day, not advice, but discussion about how you might keep the balance between chaos and order in your own life and why that's important and what that means.
You draw on all sorts of sources and experiences and indeed histories. And I would like to know, what is it I can learn from the lobster?
Oh, well, I think one of the most interesting things you can learn is that the mechanisms that we use to sort of keep track of our hierarchical reputation among other people are so biologically ancient that we share them with crustaceans. We diverged from our common ancestor with crustaceans about 350 million years ago, which is way before there were trees, for example. And so one of the things I wanted to point out is, first of all, the staggering continuity of biology across life, which I think is, I mean, the fact that antidepressants work on lobsters, although it's a comical fact, is also an extraordinarily deep discovery, because it speaks to, first of all, how archaic the systems are that keep track of our emotions, but also the amazing unity of life. And also, you know, there's an idea, for example, that's very current among radical left thinkers that the West somehow is a corrupt patriarchal structure, and that hierarchical structures in themselves are only socially constructed and are likely to be tyrannical and corrupt. But hierarchical structures governing the interactions between creatures have been around for literally for a third of a billion years, and to attribute that structure to something like Western culture or capitalism is absurd beyond. Well, it's absurd beyond comprehension. It's very dangerous to confuse levels of analysis in that way. And so I'm trying to make those points and many others in the chapter on lobsters, as well as for it to be amusing, because it is amusing, you know, that so many of the things that we think are specifically human behaviors are reflected at a deep level in animals as distinct from us as crustaceans. So I think it's very funny.
Isn't there kind of a difficulty here, though, that if we go along this logic to its ultimate conclusion, we have to believe in biological determinism, that really we don't have a hell of a lot of control over what happens to us or what we do? It's all there in the biology, in the genes.
Oh, I think that is a very dangerous potential outcome. The new atheist types, Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris and people like that, are very much convinced that there's no such thing as free will and that we're only biologically determined. And I'm certainly not making that case, and nor am I an advocate for that belief. I don't really know how to understand free will in the context of biological determinism. And biological determinism is very useful. It's helped us with many things. But I'm certainly by no means willing to assume that because I can't explain it, it doesn't exist. I mean, I make a strong case for that, I think, throughout 12 Rules for Life as well, that, you know, the functional societies that we have produced, the most functional societies that we've produced as human beings, are predicated on respect for the dignity and autonomy and sort of ultimate sovereign value of the individual. So there's definitely a danger in making things overly biological. It's a matter in part of getting the balance right, you know. So we're definitely influenced by biological forces to a tremendous degree, but at the same time, you could think maybe those are the rules of the game. At the same time, we seem to have quite a bit of latitude in how we're going to play. So that's a nice combination. You know, I kind of look at it like a game in some ways, you know, and the game of chess is ruled by the rules of chess, but there's an infinite number of variations in the game. Not technically infinite, but close enough so it doesn't make any difference.
One of the passages I came across in your book was about women and marriage and how difficult it is for some women in managerial structures to actually find a date, never mind a life partner. And the ambition to achieve that seems to be much higher in women than it would be for a similar man. Explain.
Well, there's two things about that. Is that there's this phenomenon called hypergamy, and it's the tendency of women cross-culturally to mate across or up hierarchies. And so women, generally speaking, are attracted to men that are slightly older than them, and they're generally attracted to men who are of slightly higher status than them, slightly or significantly higher status than they are, depending on how you define status. But it's a very common finding, and it occurs as well in very egalitarian societies like the Scandinavian society, so, and in many, many animal forms as well. So it's a pretty standard It's a standard phenomena, and there's reasons for it. But one of the unfortunate things that happens is that as women become more and more competent and attractive, say in their own right, the pool of mates that they find attractive shows a commensurate decline. And so women who are very attractive, young, very attractive, very smart, very personable, very competent, find it difficult, increasingly difficult, as they stack up their achievements to find men who match up. And women are pickier in their mating preferences than men are as well. So, and there's advantages to that, but one of the disadvantages is that as you become a higher quality mate choice as a woman, your pool of suitable candidates decreases. It's quite blatant in the form of IQ, for example. So there's quite the smarter a woman is, the harder it is for her to find a mate, which is, it's a logical consequence of the things we just discussed.
If she's very smart and she's looking for someone who's smarter, there's few enough smarter males around.
Well, that's the thing. That's exactly right. And that's one of the downsides of what's called hypergamy. And it's a very well-documented biological phenomena. And the evidence for its existence, I would say, at this point is indisputable. So, and it has its pros and its cons. I mean, women want to find men who bring something to the table. And the reason for that, in part, is because, well, they already bring what they bring to the table. They want someone who can bring something else. And part of that is because there's, in all likelihood, in any long-term relationship, there's the issue of children. And, of course, women are looking for a high-quality father for their children, and for biological, for cultural, for personal reasons, all of that. So it's one of the things that complicates human pair bonding.
So in the modern era, where women occupy roles as important as men do, can they not simply override this biological imperative to find a superior male and just cope with or settle for an inferior one?
Well, I don't think they can, and I don't think there's any evidence that they can, because like, you're not exactly in control of who you're attracted to. Everyone knows that, right? I mean, there would be no romance novels if you were in control of who you're attracted to. There's very little about it in some sense that's rational in the sense of a planned decision. I mean, a hypergamous choice is a rational choice because why wouldn't you go for the highest possible quality mate? But that doesn't mean that you can decide a priori what your criteria are, positive or negative, and then force yourself to be attracted. It just doesn't work that way.
Okay,
in
but
fact,
if you settle, you're always going to be saying to yourself, he's not really good enough.
Well, it isn't even, you may also be saying that, but one of the problems is that the attraction that adds spice to the relationship, and perhaps necessary spice, just might not be there from the beginning. And that's also a problem because it means that the relationship in some sense is going to be predicated on something like a lie. You know, it's not a good thing to have a relationship with someone you're not truly attracted to. Because it's hard, not only is it hard on you because you're not truly attracted to them, but it's also hard on the other person because they want to be loved and desirable. Mm. And if you're settling and you've done that consciously, well, first of all, it isn't easy to figure out how you're going to inform them of that. And then if you do, there's going to be a dissatisfaction that permeates the relationship that's just not I don't think it's good for anyone. Now, you know, having said that, I would also say that all sensible people settle to some degree because no one is ideal and neither are you. So there's negotiated compromises in relationships, but it's very difficult to go to flout the fundamental biological imperatives. Mm. And that's also the case with beauty, for example. Like, beauty is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a purely socio-culturally constructed phenomena. There are rules for beauty, and you can't just decide that you're going to find someone beautiful if you don't find them beautiful. So we're bounded by our biology, but not determined by it.
Rule number five, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. Now, it almost seems like a paradox that you should dislike your children. But you give an example at the beginning of, you know, a child being dragged through an airport, completely being obstreperous and not being controlled by its parents. So certainly you dislike the child. And you suspect that the children are probably disliked by their parents as well because of their behavior.
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist. I mean, the idea that parents dislike their children is not in the least bit revolutionary to clinical psychologists. If children weren't disliked by their parents, we wouldn't have any business. You know, children are not only frequently disliked by their parents, they're often hated by them. And many familial relationships are murderous over decades, you know, and the reason for that, in part, there's many reasons for it, but one of the reasons is that there are interminable power struggles between parents and their children, and that's usually because, well, sometimes it's because the children are particularly difficult, but often it's because the parents have no sense whatsoever about discipline or about what constitutes reasonable limits. And what I'm trying to suggest in that chapter is that if your children are doing things that make you dislike them, assuming you're reasonably sensible and have talked it over with a partner so that, you know, it's not just your idiosyncrasy that's speaking. If your children do things that make you dislike them, the probability that other people will dislike them is overwhelmingly high. Because at least they have, you know, as their parents, you have a proclivity to prefer them. And so
if you dislike them, what chance have they got with the greater world?
Well, that's exactly it. If you had to summarize the chapter in a nutshell, that would be it. And so, you know, we talk a lot about raising our children so they're free and so they have maximal opportunity and so that we don't constrain their potential. And all of those things are worth bringing into the discussion. But one of the things we've left behind is that what you really want to do with your child, especially between the ages of birth and 4 years old, is to aid that child in becoming a very fluent and desirable social being. Because most of the child's life is going to be spent with their peers and away from you. And so what you want is to produce a child or to help engender a child whose behavior is sufficiently sophisticated so that other children really want to play with him or her and that other adults want to interact with them. Because then wherever they go, they're greeted with welcoming arms and smiles, and people play with them and educate them and listen to them and welcome them. And to do that, you need to implement a reasonable disciplinary strategy. And that's all outlined in the chapter.
But I've learned so much from your book. And, you know, sometimes the chapter headings, as you say, are the broad headings. And there are pearls of wisdom found within the subtext of the chapter. For example, I learned that compassion may be a vice.
Well, that's a psychological truism. I think that was one of Freud's greatest discoveries when he talked about Oedipal parenting. I mean, if you do too much for people, if you feel too sorry for them, then you infantilize them. And that's a very bad idea. Like, here's a rule of thumb. If you work in an old age home, it's kind of a harsh rule, but if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Do not do anything for the inhabitants of the home that they can do for themselves. So if you see even someone struggling to do something, but you think they can do it, you leave them be. Because as you encroach upon their territory and do things for them, you take away their autonomy. And the psychoanalysts used to talk about the necessary failure of the mother, which was, you know, a mother of an infant has to provide everything for the infant, obviously. But then as the infant grows and develops, the mother has to pull back and continually fail. So, for example, you don't want to be the sort of mother who's picking the child that your child should date or your teenager should date when they're 13 years old or 14 years old. You've failed if you're doing that. And it's because you're doing too much. You're intervening too much. And so compassion is a vice when it transforms people into infants. And we're doing that on a broad scale in our society. I would say it's part of general victim culture.
Well, we have to leave it there, Jordan, but your book is absolutely fascinating. It's entitled 12 Rules for Life, subtitled An Antidote to Chaos. It's published by Allen Lane. The sterling price is £20, something around €20 here, I suspect, in our shops. But the author, Jordan B. Peterson, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Well, thanks very much for the invitation. It was very nice talking with you.
And up next, why have so many healthcare workers refused to get the flu vaccination, and should they be forced to do so?
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with MasterCard. Unleash your inner sports fan with exclusive sporting experiences at priceless.com.
News Talk and UCD Michael Smurfit Graduate Business School are offering you a chance to win an MBA scholarship worth up to €34,500. If you're ready to take the next step in your career, simply go to newstalk.com/Smurfit for details on how you could be one step closer to joining one of the world's leading MBA courses. Win your MBA scholarship with News Talk. Thanks to UCD Michael Smurfit Graduate Business School. Business imagined better together. See newstalk.com/Smurfit.
Layer healthcare are for the tumbles, jumps and bumps in life. That's why we're jumping on this trampoline, talking about their exclusive free kids offer on Essential Connect Family,
where you only have to pay for one of your kids' health insurance and the rest goes free.
Like me. And me.
No matter how many brothers and sisters you have, it's good to live.
Free kids by Layer Healthcare. Layer Healthcare. Looking after you always.
Insurance provided by Ellipse Insurance Limited, trading as Laya Healthcare. Laya Healthcare Limited, trading as Laya Healthcare and Laya Life, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. A kid is defined as a dependent aged under 18. Offer available from 1st of January 2018.
Renault have a new offer, and the key is 3.
Trois.
With 3% APR, 3 years servicing,
deux.
And 3 years road tax on Renault's full car range, including the Captur, Kadjar, and Koleos crossover range.
Trois.
François?
Ouais.
Silence. This is a genuine offer. Order your 181 Renault today from your local Renault dealer. Offer ends January 31st, 2018.
Finance is made under a hire purchase agreement. Terms and conditions apply. Deposit required, subject to lending criteria. See Renault.ie.
Hertz means car rental, right? But Hertz also means car sales. The Hertz New Year Sale means a massive range of cars, unmissable bargains, finance options with zero cash deposit and €2,000 minimum scrappage on trade-ins. Call into our showrooms in Dublin and Cork or online at hertzcarsales.ie. Terms and conditions apply.
Air France.
France.
La France.
Is in the air. When you fly from Dublin with Air France's Oh La La deals via Paris, you can afford to let your imagination fly far, far away. Imagine singing karaoke in Tokyo, surfing the waves in Costa Rica, or cycling around in Vancouver. Oh La La. Book by Thursday the 18th of January at airfrance.ie.
Air France.
France. La France.
Is in the air.
When you need your freight delivered on time, every time, call Geodis for road, air and sea freight services. From pallets to Europe, containers to Asia or express flights to the USA, Geodis has the most reliable and cost-effective freight solutions for you. Geodis is a world leader in global logistics and a multi-award winning company in Ireland. Geodis will deliver your freight on time, every time, with the personal touch. Call Ger on 01-811-2818 or visit geodis.ie. That's geodis.ie for more information. Geodis, we logistic your growth.
Geraldine here. Our sale must end soon. Don't miss out. In-house appliance centre, Dean's Grange Business Park, where quality counts.
This week at Centra, we have great offers across our stores, like Ballygowan Stillwater 6-bottle pack, 500ml, only €2. In our Better Than Half Price sale, Fresh Irish Lamb Loin Chops, €10.95 per kilo. Bold 2-in-1 Lavender and Chamomile Grill Pods, €3.85. And Espiritu Reserva Privata Selected Range, €7. Centra, live every day. Enjoy, call sensibly.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With MasterCard. Tantalize your taste buds with exclusive dining experiences at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
Now, just some breaking news from the UK. The death of Dolores O'Riordan is not being treated as suspicious, according to the police. The Metropolitan Police in London has said its preliminary investigation has not thrown up anything suspicious. Now, some postscripts to the interview with our last author, Jordan Peterson. Peter says, I've followed Jordan Peterson on YouTube for several years now. He's a brilliant speaker and a man of high principle. I was waiting for today for the book to become available, and I've literally downloaded it on Kindle just now. I hope it's a bestseller. Lorcan says, Jordan Peterson is a genius. He has hours of lectures on YouTube that make logical sense of the complex problems humanity faces in this day and age. Some people have accused him of being racist and transphobic, but I think those people are just too stupid to understand the arguments he makes. Great to have him on. I'm about to start reading the book, says another listener, but one thing Dr. Peterson has said in the past which resonated with me was, pick up the heaviest thing you can and carry it. It doesn't sound easy, it doesn't even sound very pleasant, but it may well add meaning to the average life. Now, Health Minister Simon Harris will consider forcing hospital workers to get the flu vaccine before next winter. So, should there be a compulsory flu vaccination for workers in the health service? Well, I'm joined in studio by Paul Bell, Divisional Organiser with SIPTU's Health Division. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, first of all, you object to this, and I'm struggling to find a reason why.
Well, I think what we object to is that should not be in any way a mandatory vaccination program for any element of the population. We in SIPTU, like other trade unions working in the health services, have endorsed the voluntary approach to taking vaccination. We've encouraged our members to participate in the vaccination program, and over the last number of years, that's shown, a growth in take up.
But it's somewhere still 39%. Low. I mean, 60% have opted not to have the vaccination, and that is lower than the population at large.
Well, there needs to be an understanding of, first of all, why we are reacting to what the minister is saying. We believe that is a violation of human rights if you force anybody to take a vaccination. And there's a number of reasons why people don't take vaccinations. Firstly, people don't take them because they believe they don't work. They may not take them because they are afraid of needle sticks. They may not take them because they believe it gives them the flu. And also, in relation to the flu that's ongoing at the moment, the vaccination, as I understand it, that's in operation, does not cater for the Australian flu.
We had the experts on, and they say, there's the A and the B. Yeah. The A seems to be fully protected. The B may not be fully, but they say it does give an element of protection.
Well, but there are many people in the population, Pat, who haven't taken the vaccination and would say, listen, I did still manage to get the flu. So if the minister approaches this on the basis of enforcing a regime of mandatory vaccination take-up, I'm afraid that's going to actually fail and it will be regressive.
But let's look at the three different things. One is that it gives you the flu is one of the points that some people say. Well, the experts say it doesn't give you the flu.
Well, I'm just saying, Pat, there's people in the ordinary, everyday population also do not take up vaccinations.
Yeah, but you guys are in the health service, so therefore you'd expect your cohort to be more informed. So the idea, when the authorities say it doesn't give you the flu, although you may have a mild reaction on the site of the injection, a slight ache for a few hours or a day, that it doesn't actually give you the flu, it doesn't give you flu-like symptoms. You'd expect your members to actually understand
but
that.
But isn't this part of where people make a choice whether they wish to take up the vaccination or not? Our members, indeed, you're right, Pat, are fully informed and understand exactly what happens with the flu virus. But there's also another element to what the minister is saying. It's almost indicating that flu symptoms or the flu virus is only rampant in the community or in the hospital because health workers don't take up flu vaccinations.
I don't think he's blaming them, but he's just saying it wouldn't be an appropriate precaution.
He's certainly putting us and the members that we represent in a space that we think is very, very much unwelcome and unhelpful, because most flu viruses and other viruses that enter the hospital are brought in through the general public. And indeed, if you look at the absenteeism levels in relation to flu virus amongst health workers. It's no different than it is in any other sector. In fact, some people who work in public transport or work in retail say we're almost as badly exposed to flu viruses as anybody else is.
Yeah. Take the second point about people being afraid of needle sticks. Now, that I have to say, if you are afraid of needle sticks, don't work in the health service. It's like saying you're a fireman and you're afraid of fire.
No, don't forget something, Pat. Some people become fearful of injections because of maybe a poor experience that they may have had, and they may decide.
Perhaps they should get another job in a jam factory.
Well, I think that's a very.
Because they're going to watch people having injections pretty much every day.
I think that's a very simplistic thing to say. At the end of the day, people cannot be forced to have a vaccination if they fear taking an injection. I think that would be most regressive. And also, where would we stop? Would we have then the Minister for Health saying that everybody in the general population must present themselves for vaccinations of any kind, be it the flu or be it anything else? I myself would recommend that people should take up the vaccinations. Am I medically qualified to say that? Absolutely not. But at the end of the day, if we go down a road of mandatory flu vaccination or any vaccination, I feel that that would also have a bad effect on people who we want in the health services.
No, you talk about people in transport coming in contact with loads of people, people in retail, and you know, handles are contaminated and people touch them, or hanging straps in a train or a bus or whatever. And they can become contaminated. But the problem is with your workers, they come in contact with the people that have been identified by the health authorities as being extremely vulnerable. So they recommend the vaccine for people who are over 65, people who are pregnant, people who've got a long-term health issue, people in nursing homes and so on, geriatrics. Mm. And they're the people that your members are coming in contact with.
Yes.
Now, what would you say if one of your members brings the flu to one of those vulnerable people?
But Pat, whether they have the flu vaccination or not doesn't mean that they would not have the flu virus. And the question that the minister needs to be asked is very simple. Are you saying that if every single health worker in the state takes up flu vaccination, that all of a sudden that flu will disappear from the environment of the hospital? I think the answer to that is no.
Number one, you won't have people dropping like flies in the employee cohort in the hospital because people will have an immunity bestowed by the vaccine.
Well, there's no evidence, by the way, that the flu virus and people not being at work in the health services is any higher than anywhere else in the general population.
Don't you have a rather high level of absenteeism anyway? Because I know in the past, and when we're not in the flu season, you will be telling me that it's pressure of work. It's the appalling circumstances under which your members have to work that has led to a high level of absenteeism.
Yeah, fair enough, but there's no evidence, there's no research that says that that health workers are actually out of work because of flu, and that it's any higher than anywhere else. What we want to encourage, and what we believe that the minister is actually discouraging, is a conversation that must keep being reinforced. Why people who work in the health service and also work in the general population should be taking the flu vaccine.
You can take as a parallel. Yeah. Why do Gardaí patrolling the streets of our cities and towns wear stab vests?
Yes.
You know, everyone's out sharing the streets with them, but why do they wear stab vests? Because they're in contact with the ne'er-do-wells.
Yes.
Your members are in contact with the viruses.
Yes.
So you'd imagine they'd put on the best armour they can to protect themselves from the virus, and that's vaccination.
Yes. Well, there's a view that the best way to prevent one from getting the flu is to take the vaccination, but that hasn't been proven beyond a doubt. But we believe, to give yourself the best chance, flu vaccination should be availed of. But to make it mandatory goes into another sphere which we just can't accept, and nor can the general population.
Some of the comments here. I have to say, I do not want a nurse or a doctor taking care of me if they believe that vaccines don't work. What kind of medical training do they get? Another one. We're supposed to be talking about educated medics here. What about the human rights of all the vulnerable people going in and getting the flu from them? Mm-hmm. Another one. Is it not mandatory for medical students to have certain certain vaccines, I think it includes hepatitis.
Communicable diseases, yes, and there are certain professions that...
So what about their human rights? They say I don't want it.
Well, they're dealing with an area where these diseases are known to be actually transmitted by people involved in medical provision. The issue with the issue with the flu virus vaccine is that it's not categorically proven that it always works. And some people, whether we like it or not,
save your life in a crash.
But don't forget the conversation.
It gives you a great assistance in maybe saving your life.
This conversation is starting off where the minister is trying to make it mandatory that people present who work in health services for vaccination. We say that there's a number of rights involved in that, and anybody who works in the health service does understand, as any other citizen, well, is it good to take a vaccine?
But is the common good something that should be taken into account? Jaw-dropping stupidity from the trade union rep. He's objecting because it's his job to object to whatever the minister says. Another one. When a selfish, unvaccinated nurse gives a premature baby or an immunosuppressed patient the flu and kills them, what then? It's profoundly selfish not to protect vulnerable people in their most vulnerable state. Another one. I was in the army for 13 years. Mm-hmm. Vaccination against hepatitis B and multiple other diseases is mandatory in the army. Mm-hmm. Nurses are in contact with the old and the sick. This should not even be an issue.
We're not talking about those type of diseases, and their members do take vaccines for those. But to be very clear about this, there's a view about the flu vaccination. Can I just say, challenge one of
the...
First of all, I want to challenge one of those remarks. First of all, people who work in the health service are not selfish. They give good service to the public. There's a view that if somebody makes something mandatory like this, it will have the wrong message and the take-up will drop and it will be resisted. At the end of the day, people who have taken the vaccine have contracted flu viruses. Also,
and I have a text here saying my husband and three kids, all doctors, got the flu vaccination and they all got the flu.
Yes, it does happen
this winter.
But also in the hospital setting, there are also members of the public, with due respect, who enter into the hospital and bring many viruses in there, including winter vomiting bug. As we know, Pat, we have this kind of even winter vomiting bug in the middle of the summer. But also, if you start doing this type of thing, you make it mandatory, there is a resistance, and then we get into all kinds of problems. The other point I want to make is the trade union movement have absolutely, to the forefront and publicly, encouraged members of staff, whether to be members of the trade union movement or not, to actually avail of this, because we believe this in some way gives some protection. However, individuals have rights.
So it's a mandatory thing. Yeah. Like, for instance here, I worked as a guard, the diver, for 26 years. I was required every year to take a host of vaccines simply because I was at high risk of contracting a disease, and it was mandatory. So that was
the issue here that the minister's raising. The minister's statement is indicating that health workers are giving the virus to members of the public. That member of Angela Shirkana, I understand fully what he's saying. He's saying, I took this vaccine because I'm walking in an exposed area. What the minister is indicating is, if we vaccinate every single health worker in the state, that somewhere along the line, the flu virus will disappear from the hospital setting. I actually reject that.
It might save a few lives. Listening to that man there about the flu attitude among health workers, I hope we don't get an Ebola outbreak.
I think we're taking things to the extreme there. But anyway, the other issue is, by the way, Pat, maybe the minister, instead of presenting this distraction, would maybe from the month of November start running advertising campaigns to educate the public about how best to prevent flu from actually running rampant in the environment. That has not been done at any time I can remember. And lots of people are presenting with flu viruses into hospital settings who maybe should be treated somewhere else.
We will leave it there. Paul Bell, Divisional Organiser with SIP2's Health Division. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pat.
The Newstalk app is Newstalk in your pocket. Download it now.
I'll give you 5,500 for it.
5,500? Really? Maybe he didn't see the scratch on the door. I just sidle over and stand right in front of it. Natural as you like.
Sir, are you okay?
Of course I'm okay.
Why wouldn't I be okay?
So, where do I sign?
Lots of people can't believe it, but Nissan are offering up to €5,500 scrappage when you buy a new 181 Nissan. Talk to your local Nissan dealer today or visit scrappageguarantee.ie and see how much your old car is worth. Terms and conditions apply. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
Let's talk holidays. Do you want exhilarating adventures and incredible journeys? Then talk to Hayes and Jarvis. Do you want to cruise through Halong Bay, experience the floating markets of Bangkok, or immerse yourself in the beauty of the Taj Mahal? Hayes and Jarvis have January sale deals on all holidays, so if you want a holiday that you can't stop talking about, then talk to Hayes and Jarvis, Ireland's newest long-haul travel brand. Drop into Duke Street or visit us at haysandjarvis.ie.
Small things can make a big difference to your health in 2018. Hop off the bus one stop early, walk the dog, take the stairs. It all counts towards a healthier you. Find more ways to be more active, eat healthier, and mind your mental health at gov.ie/healthy Ireland. Make 2018 the year of healthy changes with Healthy Ireland, an initiative of the Government of Ireland. Eat well, think well, and be well.